This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. In South Lake County, residents in the Hanover Community School District are going to be asked in the primary election, a separate item on the ballot, by the way, to approve a capital referendum question. The question is very simple, and there's a lot more behind that than the simple question itself. So we've turned to the source. We're turning to the superintendent of the Hanover Community School District, Mary McCauley, to tell us more about not only the project that the school district is asking to be able to fund with a lot of things that are on the plate on this one, but the reason behind why all this is needed. And Ms. McCauley, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we'll start out first here, I guess, with the usual questions here: who, what, where, when, why, and all that. First, if you will, tell us a little bit about, and we'll get into the details as to, I guess, a lot of why this is needed, because that's a big part of the question that you're asking residents in the district to help out. But tell us specifically about the capital project itself. We're talking, what, a total of $79 million. It sounds horrendously large, but there's a lot that goes in that, isn't it?
Yes, there is a lot that goes into it, and it includes all four of our buildings. Primarily, it addresses our issue with our increasing enrollment, because we are one of the fastest growing districts in the state, and our ADM, which is our average daily membership, has just increased each year. For example, this year we're at 2,444 students. The year before, we were at 2381. The year before that, 2293. So each year, we have seen our enrollment go up, and there is so much building around the area. So we have run out of space. Part of the building project includes building a new upper elementary building so that we can move some of the children out of our existing elementary buildings and move the fifth grade out of the middle school. We moved the fifth grade to the middle school a couple of years ago with the hopes of freeing up some space at the elementaries. The only thing that did was they filled in that space almost immediately. So we are just jam-packed, and we now have two mobile classrooms in our district.
I understand that in the last 4 years, you've added 500 students to the enrollment there in the school district, and like added even 33 just coming out of the holiday break. Is it amazing that you would pick up so many extra students in just a short period of time?
No, the houses are going up quicker than we can keep on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
To get an idea of just all of the planned and platted neighborhoods, approximately 27 more homes are planned out here. So we didn't anticipate quite the growth that we're seeing. We had a demographer out several years ago, but this has far surpassed what we had anticipated. So we have to, last year the referendum failed, so we did some things differently as far as going out to the community, being more proactive. We've done a couple of surveys. We've done something called Thought Exchange, where we've asked the community to weigh in on what they think we need to be attentive to as far as our facilities. And that is how this whole $79 million project came into being.
Now, for folks that are not all that familiar with the Hanover Community School District, most of the school district really encompasses around Cedar Lake, but there's some areas on all sides, I guess, that's part of the district, right?
Correct. We have people that live in Dyer. We have people that live in St. John, Crown Point address. So we service a large range.
When you take a look at such a large, physically large school district, and the schools that are spread out, of course, to be able to serve all these residents, you have to try to plan for the future, I suppose. And you've had to be able to make up, of course, with all this added enrollment. I understand you've even had to add some portable classrooms at some of the schools as well.
That's absolutely correct. We have a portable classroom at Lincoln Elementary because there are no classrooms left. We have a portable classroom at Hanover Central Middle School. Over at the middle school, we have more kids now than we do at the high school. So the mobile classroom is necessary because we have teachers on carts going room to room. We have teacher lounges that are being utilized, plan rooms. There is just absolutely no available space.
When it was time to be able to, and we had a lot of consultation, I know, with the financial experts as well as with your principals and the teachers and everybody on the staff of the school district, when it was time to put all this information together, what kind of material did you have to present, certainly to the school board, because they have to buy into it as well. They're just as much a part of it as well as everybody who works for the school district officially. What kind of effort did you have to make with the school board to let them know, if they haven't already known, obviously, how important this is, and also, too, to talk about the cost to the taxpayers, because they're going to have to, I'm sure, do a lot of this selling, so to speak, by themselves.
Correct. Well, we had to share the information as far as our enrollment, how much it has grown since 2012. In addition to that, we shared plans about where the new building would be located, what would be included in that, how we can address the needs of the high school, because these kids are all going to matriculate to the high school, how we can do some renovations there to address technology, trades classes, et cetera. Had to share that. We had to talk about how our AV continues to go up. Last year, it increased by 10%. This has become a destination district. People truly want to be here and raise their families here. We have an exceptional school system. In addition to that, we had to share with, and bond council was very helpful, and the board has been so supportive. We had architects come in and look at our facilities. We've also talked about how the debt can be structured so it has minimal impact to the taxpayer until that debt falls off. And the board has been integral to this every step of the way.
Now, I understand that I'm not sure if it is out there on the website as we speak, but I'm sure that if it isn't, it will be soon, that you're going to have a referendum tax calculator put onto the Hanover Community School Corporation website so that people who go onto the website, which, by the way, is hanover.k12.in.us, will be able to put in their own figures as to how much the property value happens to be for their house or commercial or business property or whatever it may be, and see what kind of impact the referendum would have, the project in general actually would have based on the referendum.
Correct. And we anticipate that'll be up next week.
Wow. Well, I guess you can't start too soon, to be sure, and certainly because you have only till May, and have everybody to be aware of this. It's really, really quite a kind of a harried situation you folks are in right now, right?
It absolutely is, and that tax calculator. What's nice about that is the average taxpayer can enter in their information, and it'll tell them exactly to the penny what they'll be paying. We also have a finance director who has met with taxpayers who've brought in their tax statements. We will meet with anyone who asks to meet with us. We're being very forthright and open. We don't want any surprises.
I know you've gone through this procedure before. The school district has gone through this procedure before and unfortunately did not get the support from the voters that time around. What is different this time around with the project? Is it the scale of the project itself? Is it the tax rate, or is there some other factors that come into it? Or is it really just the realization that we're such a growing school district, we need to have the help right now?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think it is the realization that we are a growing district, and all you have to do is drive around the area and you can see homes going up everywhere. The other thing that I think we did, it was such a harried procedure last year, but what we did, we took a step back after it failed. It failed by 68 votes. So we took a long, hard look at, okay, what did we do? What can we do differently? And we were upfront as far as getting as much community input as we could. We wanted to know their thoughts. In addition to that, we've done community forums. We have more community forums scheduled. We surveyed surveyed the community. So I think there was a lot more ownership in this.
Well, Superintendent McCauley, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. We hope to have you on again as we get closer to the day that that the referendum question will be out there for voters in the Hanover Community School Corporation and for them to see. And we hope that if people have questions, they can go on the website, get the information, the answers to their questions, and hopefully they will be able to go into the polling place there in the Cedar Lake area a bit more informed than they might have been the last time around. And we wish you all the best of luck on this.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, you're very welcome. Mary McCauley is the superintendent of the Hanover Community School Corporation, and voters are being asked in the Hanover Community School Corporation to approve a question that in turn would approve a $79 million capital project. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Hoosiers shouldn't expect full results the night of Indiana's primary election like usual. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenda Smith reports on why outcomes of many races will likely take days to finalize.
Indiana expanded vote by mail to anyone who wanted it for this year's primary, a reaction to the COVID-19 pandemic, and about 500,000 more people requested such a ballot than in the last presidential primary. Because of that, Secretary of State Connie Lawson says don't expect results Tuesday night.
I think it's going to take 2 or 3 days, honestly, before we get the final results. Some of the counties, like Ohio County, the last time I looked, they had 71. So obviously they're going to be done. Marion County will not be done. It's going to take a while.
Ohio County sent out the fewest absentee ballots, just 141. Marion sent the most, more than 124,000. The Indiana Election Commission says counties must finish counting all absentee ballots by noon on June 12th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Veterans Memorial Trail here in Lake County is moving along nicely. And we will give you an update now. In fact, a ribbon-cutting ceremony is planned for June 6th. Let's talk with Mitch Barloga. He's the board president of the Friends of the Veterans of Memorial Parkway. Mitch, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for having me on.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with not only the trail, but also what is planned there on that first mile of the trail, tell us about it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting development here because the town of Hebron applied for state next level trails money just last year, and they were able to get awarded, and they have built the trail within a year, which is like absolute supersonic speed when it comes to trail development. And they are planning to open up the trail on June 6th, which is this Saturday, and that is National Trails Day, but it's also the commemoration of D-Day, so we can't think of a better day to actually open a trail in honor of our veterans. And as I mentioned before, this first mile is part of a eventual 10-mile trail that will go from Hebron to Crown Point, and that will be called the Veterans Memorial Trail. It's actually been worked on for the last 20-some years by the Lake County Park Department, but the Lake County parcels have been a lot more difficult to acquire, where in Hebron, it was only about a mile of trail there where they had all the land already acquired, so it made it a lot easier.
I think it's important that people note that the trail is a way to connect the series of memorials that have been established in Lake County that help remember those who served and who had died in service of our country. It seems like through all the past wars, isn't it?
Well, yes, that's our goal. The parkway itself is a 15-mile corridor from U.S. 41 in St. John to State Route 2 in Hebron, and the idea is to develop a series of memorials up and down that corridor for all veterans who have served in times of war and peace. We have developed a series of them. We have finished the Korean Memorial. We are now working on World War One and Two and the Middle East Memorial, which this 1 mile of trail in Hebron will actually bypass.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think people note that this first mile of the trail that starts out there in Hebron, right in downtown Hebron, I guess at Park Place and Wilson Street, is a very important project in its own right. You mentioned here at the start of our conversation that it was, supersonic speed in getting this trail established and built. What's the procedure usually for being able to create a memorial like this? In this case here, the first mile of the Veterans Memorial Trail. What kind of work's involved in that, and how is it lucked out that it's been done so quickly?
Well, the next level trails money is pure state money, and when you're actually dealing with government money, it comes in different levels. You have local, county, state, federal, And I work with NERPC as well, and we work with getting federal money, getting that matched up with projects. And when you're dealing with federal money, you're dealing with a lot more hoops, a lot more ladders you got to climb. And the state money was a lot easier to deal with, not nearly as many permittings or regulations that they had to abide by. And again, as I mentioned, Chris, Hebron owned that entire mile to begin with. Many trails are stuck for years, much like the rest of the Veterans Trail, because of land ownership issues. In this case, it was free and clear for them to build as soon as they could. And the town of Hebron and the officials there, Don Ensign most especially, he's a former councilman, he's also a Parkway member, they deserve an enormous amount of credit for their passion to get this done in such record time.
Now, I know the ceremony is coming up on Saturday, June 6th, starting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon there at the site in Hebron. It's going to have some speakers on hand and a few speakers in person as well as by video. Tell us who's planning to celebrate, to officially cut the ribbon on this trail.
Well, certainly. We're going to have, of course, the town of Hebron officials are going to be there. We're going to have some representatives who have been helpful in getting the trail developed from the consulting company, which is Abbott Marsh. ArcelorMittal will also be there because they donated some stone for the development of the base of the trail. But we will have video messages from Governor Holcomb and also from the Rails to Trails Conservancy president. And they're going to be talking about, how this trail is again, from the governor's perspective, one of the first next-level trail projects built in the state of Indiana. Mm-hmm. And then from the Rails to Trails Conservancy perspective, how this is part of the Great American Rail Trail link from coast to coast.
Now, sir, we're still dealing with the coronavirus pandemic here in Northwest Indiana, as well as the rest of the state and the country. What things are you all having to do differently for this weekend's ribbon cutting? What should people note if they do come out there to Hebron?
Yes, of course. And people have a lot of questions. Of course, one of the best parts of it all, it is outside. So,
yes.
No confined space by any stretch. But at the same time, we're going to be limiting the event area to about 100 people max. We're going to be requiring face masks for anybody to enter the event area. Hebron police will be on hand to enforce all of this and to make sure that people do stay, the 6 foot, at least 6 foot from each other in the audience as we go through with the event itself. So we are certainly taking the necessary precautions to make sure everyone is safe. Again, it is limited to the first 100 people. And again, to keep those precautions in mind when they do show up.
Now, if anybody's interested in finding out more about not only the about this weekend's event in particular, but the Veterans Memorial Trail as it's being built, how can they find out more now?
Well, certainly. We have the Veterans Memorial Parkway does have a website, which is vetparkway.us, but we keep our Facebook quite active and up to date, and that is simply the Friends of the Veterans Memorial Parkway Facebook page, and that is the source where we send people. And they can learn more about the entire scale of the project, not only the trail and the memorial going for the Mideast veterans, but the entire scope of the project and, of course, how they can also take part and help out.
Mitch Barloga is the board president for the Friends of the Veterans Memorial Parkway. They have their ribbon-cutting ceremony coming up on Saturday, June 6th, starting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the corner of Park Place and Wilson Street in Hebron. That's where the first mile of the interned Veterans Trail is going to link up, I guess, the city of Hebron, the community of Hebron, with the city of Crown Point. And that's all possible because of federal and state help. And thanks much, Mitch, for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Building Northwest Indiana. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. My guest today is Alex Lulinski. Alex is a senior project manager with Berglund Construction. Berglund Construction is a fourth-generation, family-owned and operated construction and building restoration firm. The company is headquartered in Chicago, but also has several satellite offices, including one in Chesterton, Indiana. Some of Berglund's notable projects in Northwest Indiana include Centier Bank headquarters in Merrillville, the Mascot Hall of Fame in Whiting, the William E. Urschel Pavilion in Valparaiso, the Stardust Event Center expansion at the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, and they are just about wrapped up on a new bioscience building at the Purdue Northwest campus in Hammond. Today, Alex and I will be talking about the responsibilities of a construction project manager. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks for having me.
So, can you provide our listeners with a little background about Berglund Construction? You know, what kind of company are you? What kind of work do you do?
Berglund Construction, we're a general contractor, a construction manager, and we do a lot of self-perform. We're spread out, not across the whole nation, but we are in Florida, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. I work out of our Chesterton office, and we do GC and CM work out of that office. We also have a large restoration division with masons and tuck pointers where we, you know, restore a lot of the buildings of Chicago, Milwaukee. We're even up in Minnesota and over in Ohio.
Well, thanks for that background. So as a senior project manager, I know you're kind of working on the Purdue University Northwest Bioscience Building. Can you expand on how a project comes from an idea from the owner, and then how does it get to that construction phase, and where do you come in on that?
Well, depending on your owner, they choose their project delivery. There's several types of project deliveries. I'll go over a couple. There's design build, where you're hiring a contractor who has a team of an architect, and you design with the owner's input with the on-staff architect, and then you build that project. Several of them are design bid build, otherwise known as hard bid. Lump sum bidding, lowest number gets the job. Purdue Bioscience, that was a CMC project. They hired an architect through a selection process, selection interview process, and then they turned around and they hired Berglund. We submitted resumes and through that same process that they hired the architect with. And from there, once they hired both the architect and the CM, they had a budget. We were on board. We got involved way up front before there was conceptual drawings, basically just a couple of renderings. We then worked along with the architect and the owner, and we developed a set of drawings, set of floor plans within the owner's budget. And our role was to basically keep the architect within budget. Every set of drawings that they delivered, we would then go through and do our pricing exercises to ensure that they were within the budget of the owner. Once we got to the construction documents, that's when we turn around and we put the drawings on the street for hard bids from the subcontractors from the bid packages we developed.
So how does that bid package work with your subs? Does the lowest bidder win out of your subs, or do you kind of have the opportunity to pick and choose the subs depending on who you like to work with?
It's lowest and best value. They submit clarifications to the proposal and they don't have the complete package or they exclude something, you have to look at what they have scoped and their value. So it is lowest and best value.
You went through the selection process of the subcontractors. The subcontracts have been rewarded to different contractors. Now, where does that take you? What's the next step of the project?
Well, the next step of the project is actually the construction itself. Now your subs are awarded. They've been through the pre-qualification process. They are qualified to perform the project, and now it's, you know, putting the shovel in the ground and starting the project. And being a project manager, there's a couple steps you have to take to get to there. You have to do your logistics planning, figure out how much space, you know, you're going to get from the owner, where you're going to have your site fence and everything else like that, your schedule, when you're guaranteeing you're going to turn this job over to the owner. It's all part of the subcontracting process too, that you need to complete all that, get it into the subcontract so they're aware of the project schedule. But now that all that is established, you're putting the shovel in the ground, and you're moving forward with the construction project.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I would like to thank our guest, Alex Lulinski, Senior Project Manager with Berglund Construction. To find out more information about Berglund Construction, please visit berglundco.com.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana is brought to you by the Construction Advancement Foundation. Podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with an intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Open housing just kind of opened the floodgates and made it possible for anybody and everybody to live in any parts of the city. My father was a realtor. In fact, my father, Charles Hughes Sr., was one of the first prominent African-American realtors in Gary. He started out working for this company, Devaney, and he trained a lot of the African-American realtors, Powers, and others that are around now. He was really a pioneer in that business. And so my father took it upon himself to do what he had always aspired to do, and that was to be a businessman. So he quit U.S. Steel, and he went and worked for Devaney Realty. He was the only black salesperson there. This was a white-owned company at that particular time. And so my father was engaging. I guess I can say this and not feel jealous, but he was an awfully good-looking guy, too. All of those things worked in his favor, and he was able to cross that bridge and talk to people and get clients. And after a while, he ventured out on his own and established Hughes Realty. And he was very successful. He was a salesman, he was a businessman, and he was a personality. And I think that helped as much as anything else. In terms of real estate at that particular time, you had to battle with others who were in real estate sales, who were African-American, with selling the homes primarily of African-Americans. That's who your customer base was primarily. You weren't selling them in Miller near the beach, wasn't selling in Glen Park. It's amazing that Glen Park is so heavily African-American now. There are some young folks now that they can't envision the fact that if you're familiar with Gary at all, where the interstate 8094 is, you did not cross that bridge from Midtown. I mean, you just didn't cross it. There was no reason to cross it. You wasn't getting a job. You wasn't going to school. You had no relatives or friends. So you were sort of condensed where you could sell. Didn't affect white companies as much, because even black people had the mindset that if I'm going to get the best deal, if I'm going to get the most professional expertise, you know, I'm going to get it from white folks or have the wider range of choices. Yeah. Let me put it this way. It was more of an inclination for blacks to go to a white realtor than whites to come to a black realtor. But again, I'm going to say this now. They could go, but they weren't going to Miller. Places like that. So, and I'm not just putting the onus just on the realtor. It was a realtor, but the person selling the property too had a right to sell to who they wanted to sell to as well. If you were a black person coming to me and said, look, I got money, I want to live in Miller, I want to live anywhere I want to live, I tell them, look, I will call some agents out there, see what's available, but I'm just going to let you know now that you know what times that we're living in. It'll be difficult, but I will do my due diligence. I'll call and see what's going on. I wouldn't categorically tell a person, no, it's impossible, no, you can't do it. But in those changing areas where maybe homeowners were seeing that, well, the area's changing anyway, then they may have been more inclined to sell their homes to a black person, which would open that market up a little more. But after the open housing activities that took place, then every area, including Miller, Glen Park, and those areas heretofore that had been totally exclusively white and exclusive of blacks, then it opened up open housing throughout the community.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Kathy Schoaf is a registered nurse and has a lot of other medical-related credentials to her name, but she is also a well-noted travel agent, a special travel agent, as a matter of fact. We've talked with her before about her business, which is called Elite Cruises and Vacations. It's based in Hobart, and they are basically a special needs travel agency, helping people out who have special needs, have them an opportunity to enjoy cruises and other vacation types of things that will certainly mean something very importantly to them. Well, how has Kathy been doing here with Elite Cruises and Vacations in the age of the COVID-19 pandemic? Let's find out more. Kathy, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, these are really tough times for everybody. We know for business people as well as for individuals having to deal with the coronavirus, with the special guidance that we've gotten in taking care of ourselves and how we carry ourselves through, literally, through life, it seems, these days, with the guidelines that have been issued to us. What in particular have you and other, I'm sure other special needs travel agents like yourself, but you in particular with Elite Cruises and Vacations been doing these days to help with your clients, the people that are interested in wanting to still take those trips and enjoy life?
Well, the answer is total honesty,
mm-hmm.
A transparent honesty. The answers are not always clear as to what this current situation is, but I have a lot of clients that are excited to get to travel. Their caregivers desperately need a break, especially in these times when they have literally been on house arrest for months.
Yeah.
And many of them are more than excited to still get to travel as soon as that opportunity could be available. So we are providing them with the information of when we feel we can cruise, which will probably be, you know, later in 2020, and then all of 2021, if God willing, hoping for a really great rebound and opportunities to let these caregivers, along with their loved ones, just enjoy a few minutes of normal life, of give those caregivers a break.
Yeah. Now, for folks who are not familiar with Elite Cruises and Vacations, how do you arrange these cruises, these other ways to give vacations for people with special needs as well as for their caregivers? How do you working with the cruise lines, with the airlines and other organizations, especially at a time like this, trying to basically plan ahead and not really know what's going to come?
Well, we're working with the cruise lines that we have a lot of confidence in,
mm-hmm.
And I am always going to be staffed with professionals, nurses, therapists, at a ratio of 1-4, one caregiver to every 4 travelers. So there's no perfect world and there's no perfect answer, but we're going to try to provide all of the support, education, encouragement that we can. The cruise lines have made a lot of adjustments. For instance, it looks as if the buffet section of a cruise ship will not even be there. When they reopen, that will not be part of the options. And to be honest, we didn't use a lot of buffet options on our cruises. I have always been very concerned about keeping our clients with a medical challenge safe. And so we always encourage them to stay in the dining room, where we can eat together, where they sit at a table and they are served without all of the commotion of a buffet. The buffets are lovely and the food's wonderful, but sometimes too many choices is not what my clients need. And they also don't need that commotion and busy hassle, even when all of things were well and good. So the cruise ships are making a lot of adjustments to ensure that everything is as safe as completely possible. And it looks like those buffets are going to be one of the options that goes for now.
I know you're very lucky, you and other special needs travel agents like yourself, in having these arrangements, having this network, I guess, of cruise companies that really, really care for the people that they have on board their ships and do these things. And, of course, the coronavirus pandemic has just kind of changed everything, for that matter, the whole outlook of travel, especially travel in the seas and taking vacations away from home. So I imagine that they probably are doing things for you. They seem to have always done for you, but they may be doing more of these things for the general public someday, I'm sure. But they're using the advantage of learning something from helping folks like you with taking care of people with special needs to come up with these new ideas or different ideas?
I think that's probably true, and, uh-huh. I would hate to say, oh, yeah, they picked up from what I asked for. That would be an unfair statement, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But it looks as if that's what's happening.
Well, that's why I wondered.
They will have more space in dining rooms,
mm-hmm.
More options for sit-down dining, more items on their menu available for sit-down dining. They want to decrease the incredible closeness and clutter of people. And I have always wanted them to do that. for many reasons, for my clients just not being cognitively capable of handling that commotion. But now it appears that that's a really good combination for the general public. Yes, you are correct.
Now, for folks that aren't familiar with how you set up these very special needs cruises and vacations, how will the arrangements that you make off the boat, for that matter, to go see things, places of attractions, places of interest for folks that are on the cruise, any changes there, or would that basically be the same as well?
It's basically going to be the same.
Yeah.
I have always provided private tour options for our group. Not mandatory, but most of the clients that travel with me always choose to go with us so that, for number one, we have staff that can always be supportive if they would have a problem. But then I have a private tour company in most of these ports that will take our clients on a tour, let them see and get to take pictures and enjoy their loved ones and you know, get out and see where they're at, but not necessarily spend 6 or 8 hours climbing up a waterfall,
right?
Which is an unrealistic expectation. So that is going to continue. We will absolutely use private transports or private transports through the cruise line so that we have fewer people in a particular van or transportation, or use a lot of open air transportation depending upon the environment that we're in weather-wise, and let people have the opportunity to see in a short duration of time. We try to keep our tours at 2 to 3 hours max, because that's about long enough.
Yeah.
And people need to go back, take a nap, get some rest. You know, St. Thomas is an amazing shopping place, and then we always provide some adult daycare or memory cafe issue so that the family can go out and shop and, you know, enjoy the good stuff, all by, you know, on, with a little privacy if they prefer. But those situations are individually created for my group. And I believe that the cruise lines are going to make those kind of opportunities a lot more available to the general public. It might make my life easier in the long run. But we'll just have to see how it ends up, how the story ends up in the end here.
Now, Kathy, in the meantime, as you are talking with people making arrangements for cruises, booking cruises as well as arrangements for vacations and the like, what kind of support are you offering to the people that that count on you the most to help things make things easy for them? In the meantime, back here at home, anything that you're doing special, any kind of support efforts that you're doing back here?
Well, I have most of my clients hooked into several different caregiving support groups, all of which they have the chance to participate in, you know, if that works into their schedule or their life. But we're really trying to make those more available. The caregivers are really struggling. Most of these caregivers, spouses, adult children, sisters, brothers, you know, they generally use a lot of adult daycare programming. They use memory cafes, so that they have a break too. And none of those processes are functioning right now. So they are literally in a, I've been calling it house arrest.
Yeah.
Might not be quite true, but I'm sure that that's how they feel. And when you don't have any break at all, it becomes a very overwhelming, fatiguing situation. So we're just trying to be supportive and honest with our options. I have numerous clients that are paid in full to travel with us as soon as the travel is available.
That's great to hear.
And a lot of them don't care where the travel is at or where it's going. Let's just do something. A lot of my clients don't have a long lifespan that will allow them to travel for many, many years. You
right.
know, this is a definitive time span for many people, and their loved ones don't want to miss this chance. You know, Dad always wanted to see Alaska, or Mom just wants to go to the Panama Canal. Or Mom wants to put her feet in the ocean one more time. You know, sometimes they don't have multiple years to wait for that opportunity.
Well, Kathy, I hear the computer talking to you. It's probably a client wanting to find out more information and get back to you on making arrangements, so I'll let you do that. But thank you very much for spending time with us today here on Lakeshore Public Radio to talk about this, and the best of luck to all of you and everybody who gets involved in elite cruises and vacations. And we know they're going to just love what they do when they actually get a chance to get on the ship and go visit places, and they'll enjoy getting away from all of this for at least a little while to be sure.
Thank you, sir.
And you're welcome. Kathy Shelf is a registered nurse. She is also the owner and operator of Elite Cruises and Vacations. It's based in Hobart. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A gentleman named Mark Edward Willows lives over in the Chicago area now. He's a graduate of Governor State University in Illinois, and just across the state line from us. And after his time in school, he's spent time in broadcasting and as a host on podcasts and the like. But he's also an author. In fact, his book that is out, that's available by Barnes & Noble, is entitled Silas and Sophie. And Mark Edward Willows is with us to talk about it. Mark, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, how did you graduate basically from college, from Governor State, into the media here in Northwest Indiana? And that, of course, got us into the book.
Well, oh boy, we would be all day talking. long story short, I have been in the business since 3 years old, and I'm middle-aged today. When I was 3 years old, my parents started me out with TV commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done McDonald's. That was my very first one. And I branched out, and I've done commercials in Los Angeles, and I've done acting. And I've been involved in the media in some aspect all my life. But when I got college age, I wanted to make it naturally, be professional, get my education, get my degree. So I went to college, got a degree in interpersonal communications. My minor was in journalism. And all through college, I interviewed everyone, including Oprah Winfrey, before the world knew who she was. I believe it was the year she was nominated for The Color Purple.
I see.
And I've just always been in the business, writing, acting, producing, directing. And I also got a start at your station where you are, Lakeshore Public TV, when it was back in the day, WYIN, Channel 56.
Mm-hmm.
I actually cut the ribbon of the building in 1990.
Wow.
And there was a general manager there by the name of Richard Parker. And I just came down there and basically sat and talked with him and convinced him why I should have a show on his station. And that was it. And I've had guests like Loretta Swit from MASH, Cloris Leachman from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I had well-known people. Plus, I had local people from Chicago, like newscasters like Diane Burns, some radio disc jockeys. So it was a very good show. And I did it for, I believe, about a year and a half.
Now, did your work as a host of a TV show in this particular case and interviewing people, did that help get you, I guess, prepared in some way to become an author? And you mentioned as well, too, all the time that you spent in acting as well as doing commercials and the like. It all had to get you ready for this, and I'm sure that it all paved the way for being able to get involved in writing a book.
Oh, yes, absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, as you know, most of the people that are writing books are somewhere in this business in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, you know, people do write books, doctors, dentists, lawyers, anybody can write a book. But yes, it does prepare you. Also, being a journalist, it, you know, teaches me the style, the writing. I mean, I basically did my own editing for the book. I don't need to go out and hire an editor. So, yeah, it definitely prepared me. And also, what is so funny, all my years in this business, Chris, I mean, I really wanted to write a book for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
God's honest truth. A children's book. I've always had this in the back of my mind. And, you know, this is advice I give to everybody. If you have something in the back of your mind, you know what? Go and do it.
Well,
what's the worst that could happen?
Mm-hmm.
So it flopped. Whatever, but go and do it. Live out your dream. And this was my dream, to write a children's book. And one of the reasons, too, that I have done it, I'm from the generation, you know, being, again, middle-aged. I mean, books were big, Chris, when I was a kid. I mean, my first girlfriend was Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I had books. We went to bed with books. Our parents read us books. And I always used the old TV show, Family Affair. I don't know if you recall that show. With Buffy and Jody.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, remember that joke? Their butler, Mr. French. What did the children say to him every night when they went to bed? Mr. French, would you read to us?
Mm-hmm.
See, it was always a story. And this is something that I want to bring back today, literacy with children, because believe it or not, Chris, it's a lost art. It really is. I talked to a little boy that was 4 years old, and I asked him what is his favorite book. And his answer to me was, book, what's that? Well, that's when the light went on, and I says, I have to do something.
Yeah.
That's how really the idea came about.
That's a good way to start, to be sure. Well, tell us a little bit at first, without giving away too much of the story, about Silas and Sophie. Besides wanting to write a book, you had to have some other incentives, I guess, ideas that to be able to put this thing together.
What were they? Idea, plot line, you have to have all of that stuff. And, you know, back in the day, I used to write daytime dramas. Well, you know, those are 90 pages of script a day, so you're constantly thinking story. But first of all, you have to get some characters in mind. What do you want? And this book is about a boy and the love for his adopted dog. And to make the story short, he's a little farm boy. Silas is his name. Lives on a farm, does not have any friends. Plays with himself, whatever. And, well, long story short, he broke his arm. Mm-hmm. And this is how his journey began, where he found this dog. And it was love at first sight. And, in fact, one of the lines in the books is, when he saw the dog, she had a nose that was so rosy, he decided to name the new pup Sophie. And that's how that came about, with the name of Sophie. And there are some trials and tribulations along the way. You might bite your nails a little bit because Sophie is going to disappear for a while. But it does have a very happy ending. And then there are some other characters that are introduced along the way. But Silas and Sophie are the main characters.
Now, a good children's book always has some great illustrations that go with it. They are also usually ones that tie together with the story.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah. I had a wonderful illustrator. Her name was Emily Craybaum. Mm-hmm. She did a fantastic job. You know, I'm not kidding, Chris. You could cut these pictures out and frame them on the wall. It's beautiful. They are just beautiful colored pictures. And that's something you also need to keep in mind when you are writing a book for children. Vivid colors are very important, because technically the book is for children 4 to 8, but I have been getting a lot of email from people. Their little ones of 2 and 3 love it, and you know what? They're grabbing for the pictures. That's what they're looking at. I mean, the dog Sophie is adorable. She's a brown cocker spaniel, little pink ribbons in her ears, and graphics are something very important.
Well, you'll have to check out the cover of the book to see Sophie and Silas together. In the age of the coronavirus pandemic, I'm sure that most of this book, of course, was put together and processed and produced long before the pandemic. But in the age of the pandemic, how difficult, or maybe in some cases easy, was it to get this thing put together, or at least to get the word out about it now?
Do you know what? Actually, it was a little bit easier, because due to the fact, Chris, everyone is home, including myself. So I had the time to do it, and I also co-wrote it with a gentleman by the name of Travis Joseph Ziegler. Mm-hmm. He's a young fella, only in his 20s, and I got his input into it, and I told him one day my idea, and I says, you know, and he's also interested in the business, so I thought, hey, I'll give the kid a little break. He wants to help. Let's get this together, and this is what it did, and we would meet like 3 times a week, believe it or not, for only an hour at a time. We wanted the book to rhyme, because kids love rhyming words. We were throwing sentences back and forth at each other. We were throwing ideas back and forth at each other. And this is how the book came up. And as far as with the pandemic and getting it published and all, it was a little bit tougher in that area because, as you know, people are not in offices. But 90% of the stuff is done all through email, and everything is done online, and the book and all that. So it came about, and it is selling very well, because also people today are home, and they are looking, Chris, for something to entertain their children with.
That's true.
Are not in school, nothing. So in a way, it kind of worked out really good. And as far as, you know, when the whole pandemic thing, everything started like in about March, this book has kind of been in the works already since January. So January, February, we were working on it. March, we were finishing it up. April, it actually went into publishing.
Mm-hmm. Now, this will be available, as we mentioned earlier, at Barnes & Noble. And I assume you can go onto the website. You can Google it. You can check it there, too.
BarnesandNoble.com. Just type in Silas and Sophie. And once again, it is Silas, S-I-L-A-S, and A-N-D, Sophie, S-O-P-H-I-E, and you will find the book. And we also have, which I will say, we do have an email address. It's silasandsophie@yahoo.com. Mm-hmm. So if anybody wants to write us or they have any questions, whatever, feel free to do so.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's Mark Edward Willows. He's the author, the creator, the thought man behind the book, which is entitled Silas and Sophie. It's available at Barnes & Noble. And thank you very much for spending time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And that's it for a special edition of Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in to Regionally Speaking tomorrow.
It's primary election day in Indiana. After a postponement due to the pandemic, Hoosiers are finally headed to the ballot box. But this unprecedented election day will still look very different from primaries past. Poll workers will wear PPE and voters will stand in line at a distance. Meanwhile, most county election offices will be counting more absentee ballots than ever before, as over 500,000 Hoosiers requested to vote by mail. I'm Matt Pelser. Today on All In, we'll talk to Indiana.